several titles, novels, Yannick with a large scale structure, and probably all the talks this afternoon are going to have more or less the same title. So let's keep on going. So I think this audience knows that the simplest inflationary model predicts small deviation from Gauss regression conditions, but you can always ask how small is small. And in some models, small can be detectable, and but there can always be non-standard models that give a high primordial non-Gaussianity. And so here's a recap of possible inflationary prediction for the non-Gaussian parameter F and L. What does this transparency mean? It means that in general, F and L is defined in Fourier space through the Bayes spectrum, and in general as a complex dependence on K, where K should be considered like a vector. But many people just say something like that, where you've seen this equation before many times today, but this is taken from one of my papers in 2000, where we didn't know about F and L, so we just put an alpha there. And so you'll see this alpha appearing over and over again just because I cut the equation from there, but alpha it's F and L. And so you just say, well, let's assume F and L is constant because it's simple. And before a few months ago, it was zero anyway, so why do you care? And we should be clear that this thing is, well, depending who you talk to, it's the Bardeen curvature or the gravitational potential. And this is important for sign issue. And this thing may evolve in a lambda CDM universe. And more later, some of us were scientifically born after dark energy. And so this evolution is important. For those of us who were born before dark energy, then that's not a problem. Okay, go next. So, however, other cases are possible. And so you can imagine writing a similar equation, but instead of this being related to the gravitational potential, this thing could be simply related to density. So that's, again, it's a Gaussian plus something proportional to the square of a Gaussian, but that's the density. And so this may happen in two field models. And you can also imagine cases where we are like some defect model, et cetera, where you can't really write something like that, but you can simply say that the Bayes spectrum goes like the power spectrum cube. This term, usually the Bayes spectrum goes like the power spectrum square. So what the motivation for saying all this is that different observable may be best suited for different types of non-Gaussianity. And since you don't really know what we are looking for, then we may as well try all different observables. So searching for non-Gaussianity with larger scale structure, well, there are two ways you can go about it. One, by looking at the clustering and the spatial properties. So you can look at Bayes spectrum, tri-spectrum, etc. So the warning here is that gravity also generates non-Gaussianity, even if you were starting from Gaussian initial condition. But that's where the tri-spectrum may be important, or interesting at least, because in the next slide, I show that. And the other thing you can do is you can look at the Abunda square event. I mean, the previous talk we have about that already, by looking at the tails of the halo mass function. Now, the warning here is, what's a halo, and what's this mass, and what's a mass function? And we've discussed that already before, but let's just keep this question on the back of our mind. It is anyway interesting because one can probe smaller scales than the primary CMB can. So why the tri-spectrum? I just added this slide because there was a discussion about the tri-spectrum yesterday, and so I thought about the primary there. So the tri-spectrum is this thing, it's got some Gaussian term plus some connected term. So for Gaussian initial condition, this term does not exist, but for non-Gaussian initial condition, this term may be non-zero. And so for mildly nonlinear fields, when you can apply second-order perturbation theory, then the second-order perturbation theory contribution to this quantity here is zero. And so in the CMB, this is not a problem because in CMB, you, everything is linear. But in large scale structure, it may be an issue. And for the Bayes spectrum, it certainly is. And in this case, it is less of an issue because this part could be just put in from the measurement of the power spectrum.
So the tree level, is there really true that that's zero for large scale structure? When you say second order?
At second order perturbation here.
At the tree level?
Yeah.
Okay.
Isn't that true for the power spectrum as well, that the first correction from nonlinear evolution comes from the Bayes spectrum? You get a correction from the Bayes spectrum at higher order than you do from gravitational evolution?
So if you mean in gravity or in non-gravity?
I mean, if I look at corrections to the power spectrum,
yes.
I think that there's a contribution from non-Gaussian, from the Bayes spectrum,
yes.
The primordial Bayes spectrum, yes. That enters before the contribution,
yes.
From...
Yeah, because the other the contribution from gravity will come at the one loop level.
Yeah.
Okay. So... So if we go about and try to search for non-Gaussianity with large scale structure, so it was clear since the early 2000s that constraint on primordial non-Gaussianity from Vesci survey like 2DF and Sloan are not competitive with CMB ones. So FNL had to be larger than, say, 100 or 1,000 in order to be detected as a sort of bias kind of thing. I'm saying sort of, because later on I'm going to talk about the bias game, and it will be interpreted in a slightly different way. However, large scale structure did complementary constraints, so we'll keep that in the back of our mind. However, this calculation was done at redshift 0. Going to redshift 2 make large scale structure competitive, and that's what exactly and Ichiro showed. This is because the effective non-Gaussian strength scales like 1 plus C. And I think this was clear from the very beginning. So let's go back to the old equation that I didn't even have the FNL in there. And so if you write down the Bayes spectrum for this kind of non-Gaussianity, so this is applied on the potential or on the Verdin thing, and so you have something like that in here. And so this is FNL, this is the gravity bit, so this is the non-Gaussian bit. Let's look for this curly M is. This curly M is the quantity that relates your potential to delta, and in here, that is a 1 plus z term. Now notice that in 1999, I did not take lambda seriously, and I did not take a low density universe seriously because there is a g of z term missing, and it's because there is an omega matter missing in there. So that's for those who were for the
chemistry. Were you already married at that time?
Sorry?
Were you already married at that time? Because when I was doing this stuff.
No, I wasn't actually. And also, this term got dropped because in 1999 I had enough of a hard time to actually believe that survey like Sloan and 2DF could actually finish in time for me to graduate. Okay. That I didn't really believe one could actually measure the galaxy by spectrum, a ratio greater than zero and disentangling from bias. But that we understand why we're going to higher ratio. This becomes interesting. So there's the other way of searching for non-Gaussianity, that is looking at the tails of the PDF. The primordial non-Gaussianity affects the abundance of the first non-linear object. So it can modify the reionization history if you boost the formation of the first object. And the abundance of the rare event, such as massive cluster of high Z galaxy, and affect the formation redshift. And so what we try to do here is to compare different observables, treating them more or less with the same kind of non-Gaussianity, more or less in the same footing. And let's remember this is LSS and redshift equal 0, and compare for different type of non-Gaussianity which one will win. So let's leave this aside for a second and just clarify something about the convention. So when you compare papers from different people in different fields, they ask always two questions. What's the sign convention and what's the amplitude convention? So first, if you write this like this, when this thing is actually the gravitational potential, which makes sense to use on superhighton scale, so the large scale structure crowd, they use that, not CD crowd, then you would have a minus sign there. Then there is an issue of the amplitude, and actually two issues of the amplitude. So we should remember that there's a paper by Imal Lucena, and so if you say the string theory is that yet another convention, well, there's a factor of 5/3 and a factor of minus sign in order to convert between their convention and the CMB convention. And also, and thanks to Niayesh for pointing this out, the large scale structure crowd defines FNL in a slightly different way from the CMB crowd, and this didn't matter before lambda, but after lambda it does, because you have this term here, and this is how much the gravitational potential basically grow and it evolves if the universe is not Einstein the system. So a warning, the same author used different conventions in different papers, although not in the same paper, as far as I know. So we should probably try to find an agreement and figure out, define what FNL is for everybody and avoid mistakes, costly mistakes. Because as long as FNL was zero, it didn't matter. But if we have some reason to believe that we may not be zero, then the sign matters and the amplitude matters. OK. So besides using standard statistical estimator like Bayes vector, four-point function, et cetera, you may want to look at rare events. Rare events have the advantage that they maximize deviation from the predicted by a Gaussian distribution, but have the obvious disadvantage that they are rare. And so for the kind of non-Gaussianity that comes from inflation, this kind of test, it's not really competitive with CMB or Planck constraint, but for other type of non-Gaussianity, it is. So if you do the same mapping to the density instead of to the potential, then this technique actually wins over the other one. So let me go a little bit through the math of the so-called MVJ that we have heard about before, because I think, given the discussion that we had today, it's important to see where that comes from. So if you want to try to derive the mass function for non-Gaussian field, you want to start to get a PDF. And so it will be very easy to get the PDF if you had no smoothing to deal with. You just write down something like that, where your psi is your non-Gaussian case, this is Gaussian plus the usual FNL square of a Gaussian, and you would write in this term, if there was no filtering, you know, that would be easy. However, what you actually measure or what you actually observe is related to the density or over-density field smoothed on a given scale up. So once you introduce the smoothing, then this equation complicates, and this is a convolution with your phi square, and in here you have transfer function, you have window function, et cetera, et cetera. And so with filtering, if you try to do the same kind of things you were doing here, you end up with a complex expression like that. And this is where you start to learn to love partifacts, because then this allows you to deal with this kind of audible expressions. Okay, so after a few pages of math, what you want to remember is that you end up with an expression that you recognize by the Coulomb generator. And so the Coulomb generator, as you see, looks like an expansion series, and this has been truncated at the skewness level. Remember Marilena's talk that says this is an approximation, that's the first approximation to do. And remember, this mu here is related to the RMS of the field filtered on a given scale, and this mu 3 is related to the delta 3, the skewness. So then you say, well, in the press sector approach, I do know how to compute mass function. I need to compute the probability of objects that are above a given threshold, and then the mass function I get by deriving this property. And the press chapter may work by a miracle, but it somewhat works. So let's see what we get by applying this to Newcastle case. And so you end up with an expression like that. So once we arrived at this expression, the path we decided to take was to exchange the order of integration here, integrate in delta, end up with an expression like this, which is exact so far. But then we had to do some approximation. And the first approximation we do to truncate the cumulant generator to first order in FNL, so stop at S3. And then we use a saddle point approximation that is for high peaks, high thresholds, to do the integral. And this is actually delta over sigma high to do the integral. And you end up with an expression like that.
But, so where is the non-Gaussianity here?
In here.
In W.
So if everything was Gaussian, then you just drop this term. But we decide to stop a first order in epsilon, so you have this term, and you drop this term. So what does this expression mean? Let's look at it again. If you now take this expression and put it in the mass function, so you have to take its derivative, you will find that basically the effect of adding non-Gaussianity is to change the threshold for collapse. Mm-hmm. If you have a positive U-skewness field, the effective threshold of collapse drops a little bit, so it's easier to form objects. And this is qualitatively explains also what Dragan was discussing before, qualitatively. OK?
I have a question. And the question about the normalization here.
Yes.
So if I take R goes to infinity, what shouldn't I expect the PDF, P of delta C to go to?
Oh, okay. So this yeah. Are you talking about this exponential here that in the press factor is an error function, or are you talking about
in the press factor is an error function, and if I take the smoothing scale to go to infinity, that it becomes 1/2 or something. Isn't that right?
So
to understand what that factor of 2 that I was.
Okay, so basically we try to figure out numerically what this f would be with this sort of approach, and we end up with something close to 2. So we just say, okay, at this level, we write down how you get that number, plug this number, we get something close to 2. We are happy enough. We want to look at higher, bigger effects than.
Because it's not obvious. If you look at the P delta C expression, it's not obvious that that's going to happen at all, right?
Yeah. Okay. So is this competitive? Well, probably not, but it depends which type of non-Gaussianity you are.
What are those numbers, epsilon A, epsilon B?
Oh, okay. So this is when you put the non-Gaussianity in the potential or in the Bernoulli, and this is when you put it in the density.
Oh, the other way around.
Yes.
Is it density?
Yes.
B is for.
This
potential.
Is for potential, and this is
A.
For potential.
Yes.
Okay, so what is recommended is, as Dragan mentioned before, when you want to compare to figure out whether this kind of approach works, because, well, there are a lot of approximation going on here and we want to compare with simulation, is to use the ratio of the non-Gaussian prediction to the Gaussian prediction in the extended press chapter and compare that with observation normalized, numerically calibrated Gaussian predictions. But at the end of the day, the proof of the padding is infinite, so everything has got to be tested on simulation. So let's remind ourselves what approximation went in there. We did a press factor type derivation, high peaks to do the saddle point, and keep only linear term in FNL.
So actually, that's interesting. So this what you did is only valid for high peaks, right?
For this,
okay.
Yes.
So then there is no reason that integral could give you the density, basically, because you know it only for high peak, for large masses, but not for.
Yeah, it all depends how good is this saddle point approximation, and it depends on the type of non-Gaussianity you're looking at. Okay. So in some cases, you may actually want to step back to the actual integral and truncate in linear FNL into the integral numerically, and Dragan also had one of his options was doing that, the dashed line, dotted line. One of the two was doing that.
Once.
Okay.
Worth pointing out at this point that the approximation, even though both of them are truncated at the cubic order, is different from the one that we heard about before.
Yes, I'd say, come to that later. Okay, so the kind of n-body simulation that were compared directly with this kind of model that we haven't heard about today already was the simulation by Grossi and collaborators. Mm-hmm. And in order to compare with this work we have today, we should keep in mind that the resolution is different, the cosmology is different, the particles different. What I think is not different is the group finding algorithm, because they use two different ways to find halos and they don't find much difference. So what did you use?
Friends of friends, the simulations are different.
Anyway, so this is to show you what the simulation look like, and so this is the plot you've seen already, and the line and the points are in agreement, and let's leave all these complicated formulas.
Aren't these the ratio of non-Gaussian to Gaussian?
Exactly. So this is the ratio of non-Gaussian to Gaussian. And what we argue is that since we know that the press factor is an approximation, by doing something like that, you are less sensitive to the kind of approximation that may have gone into there. And basically, you are modeling the difference from the Gaussian. But of course, proof of the finding is enabling. And this simulation, compared with the theoretical prediction, find good agreement. We can zoom in, and for different value of FNL, and the different panels are for different ratios. So this is, at this level, if you only know about this in the world, is encouraging, because one can make prediction for a large class of model without running many expensive and body simulations. So before we go on and compare with Dragan result, let me say something about the other paper. We heard a lot about this morning from Marilena. And among many other things that were presented there, a different approximation to the non-Gaussian mass function was used. So do you remember this expression we started off with before exchanging the order of integration in the MDJ and then doing the saddle point and completing this to first order? Now, this P of delta that goes in here, it's written like that's this. So far, this is exactly the same thing. We just changed the letters. But since I copied that from the other paper, the letters are different, but the expression is exactly the same. But then instead of exchanging the order of integration to the first integral analytically and then to the approximation for high peaks, you do the integral using the saddle point approximation directly, and then you come up with an edge vortex function. And this reminds you of the expansion we have shown for the cumulant generator. Of course, you started off with cumulant generator, so you do expect something like that. But now this looks different, and you have the Hermite polynomial in here, and here mu is delta over sigma. And then after you've done that, you can decide again whether to truncate at S3 or not. And you end up with something like that. So that looks different. First, you recover the error function bit that you had in the Gaussian case, and you did not recover it on the other side. But why? Because before you did the high peak approximation, where error function and exponential are the same, but here you didn't. So let's go back to you.
So you don't make the high peak approximation?
Yeah.
Yeah, or Marilena, it's just new one.
So what I suspect is that if you want to work with high peaks, you may want to use that, and if you want to work with lower peaks, you may want to use this.
I think it's not that's not obvious. The saddle point approximation is generally a better approximation than the edge root expansion. Because the edge root expansion is a saddle point approximation where you expand where you choose the wrong saddle point. So edge root expansion is better by definition, has better asymptotic properties. I mean, both of those. I mean, it's actually fully asymptotic expansion of the interval, which you can also check by the fact that it doesn't go below zero. I mean, it actually is positive definite, whereas here you can have a regime where, where you get negative. But that's a consequence of this.
Yes.
And so I'm not sure that it's necessarily true that it, that the edge width expansion is better in any regime.
Let me go on. Everything must be tested on simulations, of course. So how different are really these two approximations? So if we screwed up something in the first derivation, or if we screwed up something in the second derivation, then we may not find the same limit when we push the two derivations to the same limit. But you can't. So for small non-Gaussian EBNI peaks, this goes to this. So the correction to the Gaussian case goes to a factor like that. And for the other approximation that has the exponential, you have already the IPX in there. For small non-Gaussianity, you expand the exponential in series and you end up. So both of them go to an expression like that. So at least we were self-consistent with the calculation, at least to this level. Okay, so this brings me to the to a question. Is there agreement or disagreement with the simulations? I think before we worry about the mass function, we should worry about the simulations. There are resolution issues, there are simulation issues, there are the initial condition issues. It's not straightforward to set up non-Gaussian initial conditions in simulations. So what I will suggest before we really worry is to directly compare the simulations and directly compare the initial conditions. Whether compare the initial condition or if not, directly the routine that set off the initial conditions. And then once this is settled, then we decide what we
do. For somebody to study, why is it hard to set up non-Gaussian initial conditions?
So basically, you are taking a Gaussian field and you are adding the square of a Gaussian. And you can imagine that the effect of that square may depend on resolution. In other words, smoothing and squaring don't commute. And also, whenever you do n-body simulation, you tend to not set down already initial condition. You tend to evolve things a little bit in a sort of mildly nonlinear way, then set out the initial conditions. It works much better this way. And in this case, evolving slightly non-linearly those initial conditions is something that Marilena pointed out at the end of her talk. Perturbation theory is complicated. It gets even more complicated if you don't start from Gaussian. And so it may be tricky. So I think there's more work to be done here before we really worry. So before I finish, let me mention the following interesting paper that we heard about before, where they find a pronounced effect of non-Gaussianity on the clustering of dark matter halo, which leads to a strong scale-dependent bias. So when Sabino Matarese and I, well, so first of all, well, I don't need this because you've seen this already from Dragon's talk, so let me go on. So when Sabino Matarese and I saw this paper, we realized that when I started working on these things, I was given a bunch of papers to actually read. And I realized that those papers had a lot of tools that would actually enable us to generalize the derivation. And so these are the papers that were sitting somewhere in my memory. The useful results obtained in the 80s give the general expression of the peak two-point function as a function of the n-point connected correlation function of the background linear mass density field. And so there is an expression like this that looks messy, but in order to get this to this expression, there might have to go through an even messier But thankfully, somebody else has dealt with that already. So you have to believe it. This required path integral, cluster expansion, multinode, blah, blah. So this is all in this paper, so you just read the paper and you go like, okay. And then you have this expression and you say, oh, okay, I can work with it. And so we have basically applied this relation to the case of started with local non-Gaussian FNL type non-Gaussianity, obtained the power spectrum that Mantel-Halo model as a high peak. And then we account for the motion of peaks going from Eulerian to Lagrangian, and blah, blah. So what do we get? So we get an expression like this. And this is slightly different from the expression we've seen in Dragan's talk. So in Dragan's, we've seen something like this, that is the bias. So that's the one to go between Eulerian and Lagrangian. And there's a difference between 4 and 2 because the bias goes square in the power spectrum. I prefer looking at it this way. And this is the correction term to the power spectrum due to the non-Gaussianity. And this is a little bit different from the expression that was shown before. There is this F of R and this M of R. So what is this M of R? This M of R, we've seen it before. But this time, it's after lambda. And so there is a transfer function, and there is an omega matter here, and there is no G factor because, well, because the larger scale structure people get rid of that, otherwise there should be a G here. And this F here is this complicated integral, and it basically gives you a mass dependence of this expression here. In other words, it depends on the smoothing radius that you consider, and the smoothing radius is the top half that gives you the mass of your object. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, so delta P sub P is this term here, and in order to figure out what delta P sub P is, you have two plots here. This term that depends on redshift, and this term depends on scale and on mass, so it's nice and can be factorized. So the redshift dependence is shown here. So you pick your redshift, and you read your delta C. And then you take the form factor here, you pick your K, and you read this ratio, and you pick your mass. Now the mass dependence is important at small scales, and makes sense. Because the mass dependent is important when you're probing scales that are comparable, that start becoming comparable to this, to where the window function of the smoothing.
Yeah, but can you really trust this?
You have to start being careful about trusting it at those scales. That's true. And so you read it and then you multiply by 4 and by your favorite FNL. So at very large scales, this is in good agreement with the expression that the Dragan presented before. But with this kind of formalism, it's easy to extend it to general type of non-Gaussianity. So the non-Gaussianity can become scale and configuration dependent. And as long as you can write the bias spectrum, then you can write this expression. Now, not always you will be able to do the integrals analytically, depending on which kind of spectrum you write there, but this is the expression in the general case. Okay. I prefer to actually show this rather than the B, because you want to see power spectrum rather than the right dependent one. Okay, so conclusion. Constraining the type in non-Gaussianity is a powerful tool for discriminating among competing scenarios. Using large-scale structure to constrain non-Gaussianity allow one to test different scales. With prediction to plug into there, and also high-resolution numerical simulation to actually test whether the approximation we do to get analytical prediction have the required accuracy. So before I finish, let me have two slides of advertisement. So this is a survey I'm involved with. That's the webpage. It's a close collaboration between particle physicists, theorists, and experimentalists, and astrophysicists, theory and experimentalists. It was awarded Consolidating Helio Grant in 2010, which means that we are basically funded. Wants to do an hybrid technique between spectra and photometry, so narrowband photometry, to go after 14 million LRGs galaxies after HD1 over between 8,000 and 10,000 square degrees in the sky. And to do that, a new camera is needed and a new photometric system is needed. But the idea is that this kind of photometry, if it's properly calibrated, can give a small enough error in the redshift of those galaxies that one will be able to measure both the angular diameter distance as function of redshift and the Hubble parameter as function of redshift via baryonic acoustic oscillation. So we are not here to discuss baryonic acoustic oscillations, we are here to discuss non-Gaussianity, but just imagine what you can do with 30 gigapascal cube band survey of redshift 1 and about 200 million galaxies. So 14 million LRGs, but LRGs are not your typical standard galaxies. In this survey, we see all the galaxies out to a given magnitude. And here are the institutions that are involved. And then my second advertisement is a workshop that I'm organizing in Florence. It's called New Horizons for Modern Cosmology, and it's going to run between January and March 2009. So it's going to run in the winter, which means that Florence will not have many tourists, and there will not be huge queues in front of the Uffizi. And so this is the abstract of the meeting, and I'll stop. Thank you.
So I just have a general question about this, both the mass function calculation and the bias calculation. So everybody's truncating this at the skewness, but
the simulations don't. Like the simulation just put FNL, and by construction they don't. Okay. As long as there is agreement with the simulation, you trust the way you've done the simulations, then that should quantify whether you can forget about higher order terms. So, however, it really depends what's up with non-Gaussianity within the simulation, and nobody has said that pi plus FNM pi squared is the final answer.
Okay, but in the analytic calculations, you just trunk it as skewness, right?
Yeah.
But for like the local type, you can actually put in the 4-point, the 5-point.
Oh, yeah. And you can do that.
For the, like, the bias prediction, does that make a difference? Do you know?
For the bias prediction,
because there are presumably cancellations between. I mean, this is the problem with this sort of perturbation type thing. Because if you truncate somewhere, at some point there's going to be some cancellations coming from somewhere.
Yes,
we know that from calculating the nonlinear.
But that depends on your primary or non-Gaussianity.
So for the local type, you can actually do that.
But you might have a third order term, right? I mean, you might not just have FNL, like, you might have an X correct. So even there, like, because the local type, you're truncating a second order, right? You might prefer order expansion. I mean, you're truncating that expansion a second order.
That's the definition, you can just do the calculation.
Yeah. But like a real perturbation, right, wouldn't stop there.
That's what Marilena showed this morning. So by truncating at this level, you are truncating at this level consistently. But if you start going beyond that,
you mean truncating the primordial at FNL?
Then you will also truncate the primordial.
No, but you can still say my model is just an FNL.
Yeah, you can say
and
that.
You can calculate your 4-point, 5-point, and put all of that
mass,
into your Halo bias prediction.
Yes, for the mass function, if we trust the Grossi simulations, then since the initial the Grossi initial condition don't truncate that S3, then it's not the S4, etc., are not important at the level given by the simulations. but for the bias, we have any
problem. I think truncations are different. As Ben mentioned, that the expansion of the full PDF is an asymptotic expansion. So you know that at some point the terms are going to start growing. Yeah. So you have to really be careful.
Actually, I want to say something. You can actually, I mean, you can calculate numerically, so the comparison between which approximation you make for the PDF, but if you truncate at the skewness, you can write down an exact expression for the PDF in terms of all the cumulants, and you can truncate that at the skewness, and you can't get an analytic expression, but you can do it numerically. And we did that and compared the two mass functions too, if you kept all orders kind of numerical.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much of this is related to what I'm saying, but so for Minkowski functionals, for example, we also have to do the edge of the expansion for PDF. Keep only the terms of the skewness. And we compare those with the full non-Gaussian CMB simulations. And the agreement was just excellent. We didn't see any sign of any kind of deviation. So maybe accidentally, it's okay.
So we're not saying it's not okay. So we're saying that when Edwards expansion has a topotic property as 1 over the square root of the square root of the small parameter, whereas the self-point approximation is asymptotically like the small parameter. So if the small parameter is extremely small, both of those are pretty good. But I was just saying, because you were saying that different regimes where one or the other might be better or something like that, but overall, if you can do the saddle point approximation, if you're working from an underlying theory where you know what's going on, you can do the saddle point approximation. And just based on the mathematical argument, I expect that to be slightly better. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe they're both good enough. But I mean, the reason to use net-to-earth expansion normally is because you don't know what the underlying model is, and you want to just have some model that also includes a three-point correlation, and at that point, that's basically the best you can do.
So when you go to I think we did this experiment and did it independently to decide to stop at S3 and compute the numerical integral and then compare the two different approximation network versus solid point. And what we were finding was very good agreement. At least that's what I was getting. And
Yeah.
It depends on the mass. So one of them
It also depends on the sign of the non-Gaussian.
Depends on the sign of the non-Gaussianity and depends on how rare the objects are. So for very rare objects, the MBJ seems to fail less rapidly.
But it depends
on the sign of non-Gaussianity.
So this whole discussion is going into how you do the saddle point approximation and what about that. But just stepping back for a moment, the first step in all of these derivations is taking the Pesch-Shecker type formalism and exchanging or replacing P Gauss with P non-Gauss. And unless if someone tells me otherwise, I don't see why. Is there any fundamental reason why that should work? Why should that work? Is there like a barrier penetration, whatever derivation of why it should work, or is there?
If you replace a spherical class with elliptical collapse, then that's the framework which seems to work, right?
I lost you.
If you replace a spherical collapse by elliptical collapse threshold, then that seems to be working, right? Doesn't that reproduce simulation?
But not using this argument.
Which argument? Oh, you mean the non-Gaussian?
For the Gaussian case, right?
Yeah,
for Gaussian case.
You're just saying there's not a reason for that either.
And you really, elipsoidal collapse, then you get much, much closer.
Yeah, but you use a very different argument for getting the mass function. You don't use this argument. You don't use Pesch-Shecker's argument for getting the mass function, even in elipsoidal collapse.
Don't you need to have PDF?
To get the elipsoidal collapse.
Let's separate. Yes, you need the PDF to get.
Right, so if you replace that PDF with this non-Gaussian PDF, shouldn't you be able to get mass function for non-Gaussian initial control with elipsoidal collapse?
It's not obvious until you put it. Because
that's what I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but I think that's his question. It's not obvious that it should work.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm just wondering. I mean, it's more a question actually than a remark.
Yeah. it needs to be done.
I mean, the practical answer is yes, it works, but...
Yeah, the practical answer is, you start with an ansatz, which is the projector. You go through the calculations. You say, well, I pick this ratio because I think it's more robust, and then you test the simulation.
But we know that the Gaussian works, but we don't know that the non-Gaussian works.
Yeah, you test the simulation.
Right. So, I mean, they believe their simulations and their tests, right? They don't believe your tests. So.
Yeah, but what I'm just saying is that before we would worry, let's compare directly simulation and initial conditions, and then let's start worrying.
Yeah, I mean, that thing you said, that I would agree with that if there was fundamental reason to believe theoretical and, you know, simulations people are just running now. But because neither one is, anyway, it's not valid semantics. So.
Perhaps something that the Sloan collaboration does is kind of useful. They started going through this a couple of years ago, and so they decided to have a common set of mock catalogs that everyone could use and test on the same data. So like what you're suggesting, so at first approximation, everyone could swap their data sets. And at second approximation, you could imagine running big simulations that were just, you know, common, and everyone could use the same thing.
So what I was suggesting is to compare the initial conditions and to compare the little bit of code that set up the initial condition and try to run it for trying to push the limit and see whether pushing the code at its limit gets the same answer or not.
So is it obvious that these two are inconsistent? Your Matarese simulations and Dragon simulations are inconsistent? Because the errors that I saw were very big.
Yeah.
So I think bigger than the Dragon's error. And the agreement was within the errors, but the errors were big. So maybe they are consistent.
But see, we do this thing with just a single set of initial conditions at a time. And so you are really doing a relative comparison, which is why you can get possibly smaller errors.
The solutions are much bigger.
The gross solution is bigger and a higher resolution.
They are bigger and higher resolution, but they have
higher resolution.
The spatial resolution is higher. I think we went through them and it's higher.
But the number of particles per kilo.
No. We should compare them.
I don't know what it goes about errors, but I don't think it's actually. I mean, we had 1024 cube simulation, 1600 megabytes. Anyway, we can differ.
Okay, well, perhaps you can move on. So I guess it's Ravi to the final talk. And let's thank Alicia.